Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Today you'll hear two green broadcasters meet on the air. Matt and Alex ask how cities can work in the climate energy crunch. Should you get out? And what can we learn from the back to the land movement of the 1970s? I'll toss in the mental survival tips I use to get through the awful knowledge of climate change. It's Alex Smith here for Radio EcoShock, and I have the pleasure to do something I haven't done before. I'm meeting somebody brand new for the first time in a way, person to person. I have Matt here from Healing the Earth Radio in Guelph, Ontario. But I do feel like I know you, Matt, because I've listened to so many of your interviews. I'm wondering if you could do just a brief description of what your show is and why you're doing it.
Yeah, well, once again, my name is Matt. I produce Healing the Earth Radio in Guelph, Ontario. And Healing the Earth Radio started in the summer of 2005. So yeah, it started out with an environmental show, but then it has grown to connect with many of the different communities of people trying to create a better world. Lots of different First Nations, Native communities, lots of things talking about reconnecting with the earth in different ways, as well as the science-based stuff and the activism stuff as well.
I think that's something that is remarkable about your show is the activism that I've heard there. Mm-hmm. And you do find guests who just aren't anywhere else. We've had an online debate a little bit about Derek Jensen. I know you just had two guests who were discussing his new book, the third book on the Endgame series. He doesn't shy away from saying, well, we may have to fight to save the Earth. That appeals to some young people and maybe to some older people. And I'm always the Mr. Gandhi guy, but I have to say that the nonviolent approach, we can't say that it's worked. The Earth is in tough and terrible shape. We may be heading into bad climate change. So it's a very narrow balancing line, and I'm wondering how you handle that.
I don't know. I just want to see a world that I can live in when I'm your age, you know? Perhaps Derek Jensen is one of the most prominent vocal advocates for, sabotage and stuff like that. Maybe attract some people who do see more of a hope in that out of a failure of everything else. Not everything else, but out of a lack of change, which we've seen. But I don't know. In that interview I think you're mentioning, it was with Eric McBay and Lear Keith. I think they're both working on the book together with Derek. And Lear was talking about how she is actually a big fan of nonviolent civil disobedience, and how in the case of Gandhi, for example, he had a lot of people on his side. And she was saying that when it works, it's very elegant when it works, but you need a massive number of people to do it. And she's lamenting the fact that there are so few people who seem willing to really change their lives or do something different than the status quo to really recognize the scale of the crises and how drastically we need change right now. So I think that's where that's coming. They're trying to figure out what will be effective to bring about a living world. But me, myself, I'm not interested in being an advocate of any of that stuff personally, or taking part in it. I'm pretty happy with the stuff that I'm doing myself right now in Guelph. But I do enjoy interviewing people like that too, because it gets people thinking. And I know 3 years ago I brought Derek Jensen to Guelph for an event, and it was a standing room only crowd with about 220 people or so. You know, a lot of people left, partway through. A lot of people left angry, and I think it spurred dozens of, who knows how many different conversations it spurred in the weeks and months following, different conversations around dinner tables and whatnot. And I think that's really great, even if people don't agree with that kind of thing. So people at least know what they don't agree with and know why they don't agree with that and know what they do like. And I kind of like interviewing people who are a bit more radical sometimes. I wouldn't say that characterizes my show, but every now and then I think it's good just to see what other people are thinking.
You know, one case that really frosts me is Jeff Lures, I guess that's how you pronounce his name, who was, he went to a car dealership just as everybody was bringing out the Hummer and all the big SUVs, and he just couldn't take it that society was going so far wrong. And he burned three SUVs in a dealer's parking lot. Nobody was hurt. Nobody was around. And in fact, they rebuilt the SUVs and resold them, I'm told. But he got 10 years, or maybe it was originally 20, and they dropped it to 10, and now he's going to get out next December. And he kept up somehow an internet journal, and people kept in touch with him while he was in prison. I'm wondering, you know, looking back, when we see what's happened with climate change and when we see what the energy cost has been just to the economy, all this money heading out to the Saudis and who knows who else, that Jeff was kind of a hero in a way. And if the car companies had listened to him and listened to all the people who said, don't build these things to get 8 or 9 miles to the gallon, perhaps GM wouldn't be going bankrupt right now, and Chrysler and Ford, they wouldn't be in this big trouble. And a lot of environmentalists went the other route. The Rainforest Action Network went up to the top and talked to the Ford people and said, you're on the wrong route. We can give you some alternatives. They didn't listen. So I wonder if we'll be going back and reevaluating people like Jeff Lures. And, you know, I'd like to see him compensated, frankly.
It's interesting. I'd have kept up, like, somehow I got on his mailing list. I keep getting these emails from him every now and then. And he writes really intelligently about climate change, and he comments on the United Nations conferences each year. And when he got resentenced from 22 or whatever it was to 10 years, the judge in the case commented on his writing in his defense, what he had to say for himself. And the judge said that it was the most inspiring or remarkable piece of writing he'd ever seen in his whole career. Came out of this young man, and he was so impressed with his intelligence and what he had to say and how much he wanted to improve the world. Because it's easy, I guess, for some people who don't look into things and who would read the papers, perspectives of these people as extremists or terrorists, as they're now called. But in fact, he was proven to have a really intelligent analysis, and he had to draw attention to how big of a crisis he saw it as back in 1999 or whenever that was. I was actually reading an article today about how, before the turn of the century, people who did kind of, you know, anti-development sabotage kind of stuff were regarded by the authorities as large as apolitical vandals. They're written off as vandals, misguided young people and stuff like that. But this article was trying to make the point that with so much funding going towards anti-terrorism stuff after 2001, the 9/11 attacks, and with so few people to apprehend, they started looking at these environmental animal rights activists who were really inflicting a lot of economic damage onto the corporations they're targeting through consistent campaigns, sometimes involving illegal stuff, mostly just involving legal stuff, and through a very strong lobbying effort on behalf of industry groups and those kind of lobbying efforts, in conjunction working with the FBI and numerous other authorities like that, they kind of rebranded and reprioritized these kind of activists as no longer apolitical vandals, but actually terrorists. And then with the huge the Green Scare wrap up, you know, the Green Scare arrests from 2005-2006, where they arrested nearly 20 people for crimes from like nearly 8 years ago, calling them all terrorists. They, of course, got to justify the amount of money they spend into anti-terrorist funding. Yet none of the crimes people committed even came close to harming a single person except corporate profits. So I thought that was an interesting perspective on the article. And I don't know, it's hard to say how future generations will look upon people today. I daydream sometimes with the headlines in the future, you know, if there are newspapers in the future, or the history books or whatever, the oral history, whatever is around, what will be passed on. I mean, I imagine to the great-great-grandchildren or the future generations of today that it'll be so painstakingly obvious, even to ourselves reading the papers and seeing the headlines that pop up, it's so obvious how dire things are. And especially when you get into the articles that only make it to the European press, say, and not to the North American media, with regards to climate collapse and all that. So who's to say if people will wish there had been a whole wave of, you know, environmental guerrilla people, you know, preventing the industry from continuing. Who knows if people will wish that. I guess they would wish that we had done whatever possible to just stop the destruction of the earth and get back in harmony with it. But it's very complex when it's in the real world, and those things involve great risks and are often, it's hard to justify some things too that some people advocate as well.
Well, you know, we have seen a couple of positive changes here in this city. For example, I never thought I'd see this. They finally banned lawn chemicals, you know, the herbicides and even the pesticides for lawns. So we've made it so that people will stop poisoning their only possible food source should economic times get really rough, you know, the Victory Garden idea. And there's more talk in the White House even of having their vegetable garden there at the White House. Okay. So there's some progressive things happening. I know also here in the city they've recently made it possible to have chickens and passed a bylaw in the area where I live that you can have bees again because we're running short of bees. I feel there's this sort of, maybe the economic crisis has done it, there's this feeling like, oh my God, how would we feed this city? We've already built over the best farmlands, you know, we turned those into paved suburbs. I think some of those suburbs will die off and be plowed up again and grown for food. We'll see.
Progressive Radio, Green 960 AM, San Francisco. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, wading through the deep green with environmental broadcaster Matt. His long-running show, Healing the Earth, runs out of the University of Guelph in Canada, but his guests, some of them controversial, come from all over the world.
Okay, well now I just want to reverse things a little bit. I'm going to hand you back this microphone, and you can ask me any question you like.
You mentioned in one of your emails to me that you had also lived in some kind of land community, some kind of intentional. I guess I'm curious to know a bit more about that context for you, because a lot of people of my generation really see the insanity of the city life, you know, and see even this the enormous requirements of just social organization and feeding large concentrated amounts of people on relatively small amounts of land. So I'm curious to know what you think of what potential there is for a different kind of back to the land movement today, if you see anything as possible.
Well, it's amazing you should say that, because I was thinking just last night that it's possible that a new back to the land movement will come, just out of the economic crisis, but also from the climate crisis and the peak energy situation. When I left society, so to speak, the world was promising to blow itself up with nuclear weapons. We're talking in the late 70s. They had put all these thousands and tens of thousands of nuclear weapons on computer that would react within seconds. But the computer systems were kind of shaky, and we weren't sure who could push the button. And there was also the whole corporate culture. Having gone through the late 60s in university, I just couldn't put on a tie and sell my soul for 30 years and hope there was a pension at the end of it. It just wasn't for me. So, yes, I went back to an area just south of Algonquin Park. There was 200 acres there that had five people living on it. They said, well, you know, a couple thousand bucks, you can become a partner in this thing. And it turned out there were about 500 people who had left and to come to that area because the land was so cheap. And there was a common ethos of we set up a food cooperative, you know, in order to bring in fruits and vegetables and distribute them ourselves and bypass sort of the supermarket system. We had exchanges going on where one person raised a whole bunch of this and somebody else raised the rhubarb or whatever. People started to have kids, and so there was a lot of cooperative child raising going on. Everybody had their own cabin or house, but they weren't very, you know, by today's standards, this was not a $200,000 house. And in fact, the house that we built was mostly built with reused materials by going out and knocking down homes that people didn't want anymore but had really good wood in them and stone and rebuilt that. Gathered stone from right around the stone fences in the farm there to build the chimney, that sort of thing. Cut our own wood for the flooring. So we were trying to live from the resources that are right around us, learned about the wild foods that were there. It's difficult when the winter's 6 or 7 months long to be a vegetarian as such. So some people did, you know, raise chickens or even raise pigs and had a cow for milk or whatever. You had to have a relationship with animals to make it through that kind of thing. What we found was that as the years progressed and society didn't fall apart, it did have a difficult point. Chrysler went bankrupt then, as it's about to do now, in 1981. New York City went bankrupt right in that period. So there were a lot, and interest rates went to 22%. A lot of people did have to walk away from their homes. There's a lot of parallels to what's happening right now. But the situation now. I just had a guest on my show today who said that his grocer in Ottawa, Ontario, knew when the truck was leaving from Vancouver, 5,000 miles away, with his next batch of supplies for his little grocery store in Ottawa. So you got a 5,000-mile-long truck supply line for food. And I know from my own efforts to try and collect food recently here in bulk that there's no food warehouses around to speak of. It's all just-in-time delivery. The truck comes right from Mexico to the doorstep of the IGA or the Super Value or whatever it is and unloads. So it's really fragile, and that would make me very nervous about our food supplies. Also, we've come to the point, certainly in this city and in most American cities, where there's no way the city can feed itself from the immediate environment around it. And so if you're young enough, I'd say this is a really good time to go out and learn how to feed yourself and get back to the land. And I think if you're going to do that, you should take climate change into consideration. Is that river that's running near you still going to run, or is it depending on a glacier that won't be there?
I'm curious to know, from the knowledge of the up-to-date science you have on the climate, how that has been affecting you. Because for me, it made me really sad listening to some of your shows about a month and a half ago or so. Pretty depressing stuff in some ways, and it takes some effort to find the light through it all. So I'm kind of curious to know how it's been affecting you, if you've been able to internalize what that really means.
You know, I interviewed a scientist a couple of days ago from Australia, Dr. Glickson, who is one of the scientists who's willing to speak out about our real situation. And he sees us heading for a climate catastrophe. And after the interview, he asked me how I was doing. And I said, well, I have to tell you, I've been a little depressed the last month and a half. I'm wondering, why am I doing this radio show, and am I doing anybody good? Because I haven't seen the changes, that are going to save us anywhere near developing, and it looks bad. So he said to me, well, there are a couple of ways that I handle that. He does believe in Gaia. He's not religious at all, but as a scientist, he does accept James Lovelock's proposition that all the creatures, all the living forms on the earth, are in some way working together to support each other, to make life possible, that even the algae in the sea makes the oxygen that we breathe, and without them, we don't make it. So he feels that it's always possible that this super system may allow us to live. And if so, we may be running around up around the Arctic Sea. It'll be kind of tropical up there. There may be alligators up there. We're talking, we don't know when, 500 years from now or 300 years from now or 100 years from now. We don't know how fast that's going to move. But he says humans are so intelligent that they will work those things out. He has some hope for geoengineering, which I fear myself, but he feels that, when our backs are up against the wall, we may learn how to spray seawater into the air and make more cloud cover, which would cool us off long enough that we could dismantle the coal mines and the coal power stations, that we could adapt to some degree. Some people who now live on the tropics are pretty well adapted, and the tropics won't heat up as much as the northern hemisphere and the poles will. So there's some hope that a tropical lifestyle might keep going. And also he started out as a geologist, and he goes way out into the outback of Australia, and he's studying craters that are a couple of miles across where some asteroid hit. And those asteroids and then the eruption of great mountain chains changed the climate again and cooled things down quite a bit all of a sudden. So there's also hope that some unseen force, like a lot of Mount Pinatubo is going off at once, could cool things down again, and we might come to our senses and bring some of the carbon out of the air using whatever smart technology we can come through. So I'm just babbling here, but I'm saying nobody knows the future. Certainly I don't. So there's always the possibility that we're in the dark point before that dawn might happen. I don't see the dawn happening through Obama, I have to tell you. Some good things have happened there. He's got some good scientists in place, but it's not moving anywhere fast enough through any of the national governments to save us at this point. But he's also saying that Carl Sagan, the great astronomer, wondered whether we hadn't just had a chance to have a glimpse of what the universe is about, that we represented the universe developing the capability to look at itself. We were like an eye opening. And eyes open and then eyes close. Everybody's eyes open and close. So it could be that that humans as such may not make it. But again, he looked at periods where 95% of all life forms were killed off, where the rocks are almost dead in any record of anything living. And yet, within 10 million years, big life forms developed and a whole raging race of new life came forward from the Earth. So we are not capable in any way of killing off life as such, which is good news. So something is going to follow us if we don't make it, and yet the chances are good that some of us will make it. So he helped me lift some of that depression. And I also say that I'm just really grateful for the fantastic life that I've had. And this is a good time I'm having right now with you. And I know I'm going to have a good time tonight and tomorrow. It's just that ability to enjoy life at the core, even if it's the worst of times and you're going to die tomorrow on the sidewalk out of hunger, today you still have that spark of life in you, and you can't put a price on that. It's just really, really important to find that spark of life and to enjoy it. So I do have the capability to enjoy life despite this terrible news. Somewhere deep in my soul, I never give up hope. I see that things that are beyond my conception have already happened. You know, I couldn't believe that we could be alive at the time of great climate change. And then this economic change as well, and all the things that oil we're going to have to change. Those great things have already happened. So who knows? There could be a fourth and a fifth thing coming down the stream that will make it all worthwhile. That's my feeling.
Yeah. Once again, my name is Matt, and I produce Healing the Earth Radio. In June of 2009, we'll be entering its fifth year, and that is produced out of Guelph, Ontario. And the website for the show is www.resistanceisfertile.ca. Thanks.
And I'm Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. It's produced out of CFRO in Vancouver, Canada, and broadcast by 16 stations. And I'd like to thank you, the listener, for participating in this conversation. And if you want to go further with that, you can send me an email at any time. My address is radio@ecoshock.org. And I really enjoy getting your email, and I think Matt does too.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. You know, I'd love to hear from you too. My email address is healingtheearth@resist.ca.
That's it. We're out of here. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed that exchange with Matt. It's not easy doing radio about a gorgeous ecosphere under attack, in decline. My hope is kind of lame, but it's still there. Maybe hope is built into all of us, the ultimate survival trait. I'm Alex Smith. We're out of time. Thank you for caring about your world.